Welcome to Political OD, episode 35. Planned, I think, to record last week, and then obviously Death of Her Majesty has put us back a little bit, and it would be wrong not to open with comment on the passing of Her Majesty, which is very much a time, I think, when the country remembered what it was and who we were as a nation.
Yes, I mean, it was such a sad occasion, obviously, because we'd lost somebody who was so significant in all of our lives, really. But it was also a time for reflection, a time to sort of consider what we are as a country and what the value of that is. The Queen really was a symbol of sort of British values and of the institutions that held us all together, and she was perfect as that figurehead. She was also somebody who oversaw enormous changes in modern Britain in the United Kingdom. I mean, she was born, we remember, in the 1920s, and the differences that have taken place between then and now are just really almost indescribable. When she was a girl, Britain would have had an empire that would have spanned most of the globe. She oversaw that change to the Commonwealth, and she did it with a grace and a dignity and a kind of a leadership that was exceptionally important in helping the country make that transition. There weren't many kind of bum notes over the last 10 days, but there are obviously the very odd kind of person who still regards the Queen as some sort of emblem of imperialism or emblem of colonialism. I think they're few and far between.
On the point of empire, which colonists would say would be in a time of domination, and she was very much central to a process that, if you want to use the colonialist, anti-colonialist term domination, she moved from domination to cooperation. And you know, given that that was drawn out over a long number of years, that was quite a singular achievement. And I'm not saying the transition was perfect or without its troubles. We just had the Commonwealth Games, the Friendly Games this past summer. There were initiatives of the Queen that stretched across the Commonwealth that people were engaged in. Very, very soft power, perhaps, if we want to call it that. But nonetheless, I can't imagine that political leadership would have achieved the same. It required that central, stable, determined, perhaps, but confident, small voice in the centre that allowed that to happen and was able to bring people in. We've seen South Africa come back into the Commonwealth after the ending of apartheid. We saw Mandela very much with the Queen and enjoying her company. A tremendous force for quiet revolution, perhaps, or quiet change that happened without us almost noticing.
Yes, and I don't want to blame her for conservatism necessarily, but I mean, of course, that kind of managed change is a central tenet of conservatism. And you know, I wrote earlier in the week my column for the newsletter, and I used the phrase from Roger Scruton, who called the Crown a kind of light above politics, and of course it does have that role. But while it's not an explicitly political institution, it does have political significance, and the Queen, in her way, was a political figure, albeit that she wasn't a party political figure, or she wasn't a figure who, you know, imposed her views. But I mean, by her example and by her leadership, she did have a political significance. What we're talking about here, the Commonwealth, was something that she was passionately interested in, and at times certain political leaders, certain figures in her court, we think, would have preferred that she wasn't so engaged in these issues. And I'm not sure that if you'd taken another figure, another monarch, that transition from an empire to a Commonwealth of friends could have been managed in as successful a way as it actually was.
Partly, I guess that's longevity, but I think we also have to look at the nature of the monarchy as well. I think it embodies tradition without holding back modernity. And that's something that was very much part of her world. And hopefully that will also now be passed. I was struck as well how quickly we moved from Queen Elizabeth to King Charles. It was an instant change. You know, he became king upon the moment of her death. The queen is dead, long live the king. His announcement immediately after her death, I thought it was a very personal presentation, but one where he quite understood the nature of the crown and its place in the country.
Yes, and of course these things have been worked out over very many years, because one of the kind of, I suppose, benefits of the Queen's longevity is that we've known as a country that this day was going to come.
And
we've had a chance to work it out, as have courtiers and the people who provide advice to the monarch and her successor. I mean, I was surprised and delighted by the sort of wave of enthusiasm and allegiance and love almost that the country showed for King Charles on his succession at such a sad time. It could have been a time when the kind of overwhelming emotion was uncertainty, perhaps apprehension for what was coming. And he's managed it absolutely perfectly. He didn't strike a wrong note. Long may that continue, but this is the benefit of constitutional monarchy, an institution, incidentally, which is distinctively British, and it takes the kind of party political edge out of who's going to be the head of state. It's just a tremendously stabilizing and beneficial system.
I think, Owen, it also happened just at a time when politically there was a degree of instability, because, of course, 2 days before Her Majesty died, she had just received the new Prime Minister, accepted the resignation of Boris, and the new Prime Minister becoming Elizabeth Truss. For Prime Minister, obviously, it was almost as soon as she got the job, she was thrown slightly off course. She was suddenly thrust into a very prominent central role in the various services and events around the period of mourning. She couldn't complete her government because, of course, she couldn't get new ministers approved until after, she won't be able to get a number of junior ministers approved until after the official period of mourning of the royal family. And she had a lot of announcements to hit the ground running that didn't happen. The Crown has provided a continuity just at the point where we were, in fact, entering a period of, I suspect, a great deal of political upheaval, not least because I think for the first time in a long time, Liz Truss offers a new approach to government, which seems to be very much more about reducing regulation, freeing up people to spend their money as they feel they ought to, a responsibility being thrust back to the individual and away from the state, you would hope, or I would certainly hope, but at the same time, being prepared to step in quite largely in the energy market and prevent the worst impacts of energy costs in the broader context of a cost of living crisis, which itself is largely a factor of cheap money and energy costs.
When Boris Johnson came to power, there was an expectation that he would actually herald this kind of new dawn of classical liberalism, if you want, of the government sort of stepping back and not taking such a sort of bossy role in people's yes. lives, stepping out of the economic sphere and kind of letting the markets set the tone. And that actually didn't happen. His defenders will say that was because of many factors, including the pandemic. But, you know, when things like that happen, that's really when you see that's the test of whether people have got this kind of liberalizing tendency or liberal tendency or not. We're now seeing more of it in Liz Truss. We hope that it will continue. She has made these announcements in the energy market. And I think, you know, in order to kind of get off to any sort of positive start, that the government did have to make an announcement, and quite a sweeping announcement in that area, because it was causing enormous anxiety and uncertainty. And the scheme that she's unveiled promises at least to stabilize that situation so that we're not held hostage to this market that's so volatile.
been impressed by the fact that she came in as has set a small number of priorities, and that seems to be replicated in other areas. You know, Therese Coffey, the new health secretary, made a statement on three tasks that she had to do. You know, it's not the I will come in and do everything in the. These are the three things I need to do, and that seems to be replicated across the board. You know, a small, limited number of things to do well. That kind of suggests that we are looking at a slightly more limited government in terms of focusing on the day to day rather than on the grand policy statements and the big gestures. And I think we've had a lot of that because technocrats loved the big gesture, but perhaps the delivery gets set to one side from time to time.
Yeah. And I mean, that you're putting your finger actually on something, one of the bugbears that I have about modern politics, and it's this pressure to be constantly generating policy announcements, papers, and it's driven in part by the media. It's driven in part also by this sort of industry that is built up around government of lobbyists, of campaign groups and everything else. And, you know, a good government will know when to leave things alone and will be clear about its aims and clear about what's wrong, clear about what isn't a problem and what doesn't need to be changed. And it will go and, you know, it's kind of the keyhole surgery analogy. It's going in, putting specifically the things that need to be put right, and legislating where that's necessary, but just keeping the hell out of people's lives otherwise. And I think that's what we badly, badly need at the moment.
That also seems the approach on the protocol, which we almost got away with not talking about. But in the protocol or in the relationship with the EU, very much it seems to be, no, we're going to put this legislation through because we want to keep the EU honest. You know, we're not going to hold up on it, and we're going to negotiate, but that negotiation has to be honest, and we know the point that we need to get to at the end. And that seems to have had an impact. I noticed the EU were putting out statements that probably nobody was much picking up on over the period of mourning, because they possibly just wanted to put stuff out there. Of course, the government couldn't respond because it was trying not to be political over that 10 days. I thought the EU was coming very close to where the British government protocol bill was wanting to end up at.
Yeah, well, the government, or the EU rather, has this way of doing business where it broadcasts these kind of broad, vague statements. And, you know, the difficulty is that sometimes if you actually delve down into what they're saying or look at the actual documents, that the detail doesn't sustain that. So I don't know whether we're talking about something that's genuine and new and transformative or not. But I mean, I suspect that what's happening is that they're communicating in a way with their enthusiasts, giving them another line to show that the EU is being reasonable and that the British government is being, you know, rather cavalier and charging forward with this legislation when the negotiations actually have some capacity to go somewhere. I'm a bit cynical about how genuine those overtures are, but you're right, we're going back to talking about things that sound an awful lot like you know, was it Max Fack that they called it, maximum
coordination,
where things were managed by data sharing and computer systems, and the checks were low key and infrequent. But the only thing that I would say is that the Irish Sea border, the protocol, has an impact on business, and it has an impact on trade, and those things are very serious and they have to be dealt with, but it also has constitutional significance. And the constitutional significance is, for instance, the fact that Northern Ireland can't, in theory, just avail of British rules if they develop out of line with the single market, that we're beholden by single market rules on goods and agriculture and other areas, and also that we're subject to the EU courts. those things have to be dealt with too. And if the EU is just saying, you know, we'll make this easier for you, we'll do fewer checks. That's at this point, this isn't really enough. I'm always skeptical until I see delivery. But the things that Liz Truss has said so far, and the fact that she's gone back to her legislation and pointed out the sort of three or four key aspects of it that need to be addressed and that the EU need to address, it gives me a little bit more confidence. And I mean, again, we're sort of going back to a government that has so far in the very, very short period of time that it's been in operation, been a little bit more specific than its predecessor. With Boris, we had all this bluster. What does he mean? What are they going to do? You know, Liz Truss so far has been pretty specific about what she wants to see from negotiations if they are going to form an alternative to the bill that she's putting through Parliament. And I think
it does seem a much more focused agenda. And that has to be good in negotiations generally with anybody or at any level. It gives a degree of certainty for civil servants and for other people to know what they're dealing with and what are the limits, how far are they going to be able to push things?
Yes. And I mean, we know a lot in this country about the so-called sort of power of constructive ambiguity to get things done. But with the EU, you really don't want to end up in an ambiguous position, because we've seen that they will take the most unhelpful line possible in order.
It has to clear up. I think the pressure so far has been working. And I think it's time. You know, it's not the time to let that pressure relax in any way, which does kind of bring us to the more local issue of the possibility of an election being called at the end of October. Not the election happening at the end of October, but under legislation, the Secretary of State is obliged to call an election if there's no government by the end of October. He wasn't exactly committal to making that decision, but he didn't demur from it either when he was asked this past day or so. Bets on an election being called at the end of the month?
It's possible. I mean, I think it's something that most people want to avoid. Certainly the public, I don't think, really has a great deal of appetite for it at the moment. Some parties might feel that they can improve their position out of it. Other parties will be pretty anxious that they may fall back. And that the last result won't be so significant. If it came down to, you know, taking £20 of my own money and putting a bet on, I think I would prefer to keep the £20.
Good evens.
Yes.
You know, there are both pros and cons for all the parties, I suppose. The Shinners would hope to get an extra seat or two, but I can't see where that vote would come from. It's a pretty maxed out vote. The SDLP must desire to get an extra seat back or two here and there to put a bit of extra effort in.
Again, where would that be?
Well, where would that be? I mean, that vote's slightly... On the unionist side, I think the Ulster unions would probably stand still for the most part. But I think there would be a good chance of some of those TUV voters that voted TUV because they didn't trust the DUP anymore might well go back to the DUP. So it might give them an extra couple of seats, maybe not to be the majority, but certainly an extra couple of seats. And that would do no harm in the broader issue of keeping the pressure on the protocol. It's a risk for everybody, whether it happens or not. It's all down to the Secretary of State. The law says yes, but we've seen before that can be stretched somewhat in the world of elections. I would say an election's more likely than not. If the current government is as straightforward as it suggests, it'll just say, well, that's what's going to happen. You just couldn't agree, here it goes.
I mean, there are of course ways and means of getting around it, but it does seem to be straightforwardly the kind of interpretation that you would take from the rules as they stand. So it could be that is what happens. It'll take somebody to either back down in a way that perhaps wouldn't be welcome, or something to change dramatically in the meantime. And it's difficult to see that kind of change can happen in such a quick timeline.
I think it'd be interesting too that if there was an election called at the end of October, mitigations on energy bills would be landing with people while an election was on, which would kind of say that all those people shouting that we need Stormont back would be put in a bit of a box, because in fact those payments would be made anyway. So there's a calculation in there, and or a talking point perhaps in there about, you know, how much is Stormont needed. And I think on these big, particularly on the big energy issues, not a lot actually. In the cost of living, most of it's down to energy, and Westminster is the only government in the United Kingdom that is seriously able to deal with that.
Yes, and it's much more effective and direct as well. It doesn't go into the kind of Stormont mincer, and you know, the cash ends up being sloshed away in something else. So yeah, the government, in my eyes, can do anything it likes to sort of help the cost of living, certainly anything that Stormont could do. It's just whether it's prepared to kind of set aside its squeamishness about being seen to kind of enact elements of direct rule. And we've seen that in some areas it's fairly happy to be assertive and to step on people's toes. So I mean, I don't really accept the argument that if Stormont isn't up and running, that there's any restrictions as to what can be done for people. I mean, the idea that Stormont has to come back or that people have to starve, it's not valid.
Just maybe to go off on a slight tangent, but also on point, and the requirement for Westminster to address energy. I think that, you know, we've talked about cost of living, and that's obviously a big factor. I think the other factor that is in play is also the war in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin has quite clearly tried to use energy supply as a weapon to weaken the West's resolve in respect of supporting Ukraine. I think that Liz Truss is putting so much money into energy cost mitigation, showing that they will do whatever it takes not to let the Russians create instability and difficulties for the home market, as it were. Opening up fracking, perhaps, certainly giving licenses out in the North Sea for greater oil and gas production, and committing as well to continuing to support Ukraine, perhaps with increased military budget. Of course, we are training huge numbers of Ukrainians here, which is probably more training than half the Russian army will get from this new 300,000 conscripts that they're about to throw into the theater in a very weakened position for the Russian military in eastern Ukraine.
Yeah, well, I mean, the 300,000 conscripts are essentially reservists. So these aren't the kind of front line of troops. I mean, not to go off on a complete tangent, but I do think that you're seeing a new phase of this war, whereby Russia's aims are no longer to take territory, but rather to hold on to the territory that they've got, in particular, that land bridge to Crimea, because the Crimean Peninsula is very vulnerable to attacks on that bridge and the Kerch Straits, which was previously the only
land access
to Crimea for Russia. So I do think that what you're seeing now is Putin saying that the aims of the war are to solidify those areas that Russia has in its possession, particularly the Donbass, Donetsk and Lugansk. So the fact that he's bringing in these extra troops, I think, is aimed at realizing that aim, rather than switching the war around completely and coming in with a new counteroffensive. But absolutely, from the Western perspective, from the UK perspective, policies of the government are perhaps aimed at giving a little elbow room to be able to find alternative sources of energy, and therefore not have this reliance on Russian gas that then gives Vladimir Putin a sort of...
Of course, the UK itself doesn't have much reliance on Russian energy at all, although...
No, but it has an effect on the overall price of energy. But
I thought on that front, it was interesting in the past day or so that we've seen that half of all gas now into Europe, half of what was imported from Russia, has now been replaced by Norwegian and Algerian gas. And of course, LNG plants are being created, areas are being created in Germany, and certainly more LNG will come in from the United States and elsewhere. You know, it seems that Putin is acting certainly in a short window where the energy issues aren't going to be as sharp in Europe this time next year as they are today. And so maybe the 300,000 reservists being called up is simply to just do anything, as you say, to hold on to what he's got through the winter and hope to rearm, because, of course, they've lost so much in arms and up to a third of their very best troops in the conflict so far there.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's exactly what's happening at the moment. And there's also this sort of rather chilling specter of nuclear weapons, because I think also what's going to happen is that you're going to see these referenda taking place, particularly in Luhansk and Donetsk, but also potentially in other areas too, whereby these areas will be seen as part of Russia quite shortly. And therefore, it will, in the Russian mind at least, justify a stronger response if those areas are attacked, because it's seen as an attack on sovereign territory. I think that was the rhetoric that we were hearing today.
I hear the nuclear rhetoric, but I also see that the conference that Putin attended last week, was it, in Central Asia, with China and India and North Korea and a few other people that he might have regarded as friends, not being terribly supportive. He had to actually publicly admit that China wasn't exactly on side. I mean, the Chinese have played a bit of a blinder diplomatically. I mean, they've managed to give a nod to Putin entering Ukraine, but at the same time, not actually giving him any public support, and largely taking a world rival out of the picture. They would see themselves as perhaps now the only counterbalance to the West in any real sense. And they've got a cheap supply of gas and oil, because I suspect Putin will have to find new markets as the world resettles. So China have probably done all right out of this. And if Putin thought that, having sat down with President Xi, that he was in some way, getting support all the way back last year in February or March when they met, I think he must be sitting there wondering exactly who his friends might be in the future, because...
Well, China wouldn't have been upset to see this war taking place, because it acts as a source of disruption to the West and rival markets. But it's certainly not prepared to hitch its wagon to Putin's campaign. And now that the war is sort of turned a little bit, that it seems to be going in the Ukrainians' way, you've seen this effort to distance itself from the Russian campaign. So I would imagine that what you'll find is that China again just tries to keep that very neutral position, where it will bank the kind of gains of there being a conflict in Europe, but it won't particularly provide any practical help to the Russians in terms of their campaign.
No, on the downside for China, whilst it's gained a bit of extra space for itself, as it were, in the world order, the conflict has also seemed to have created greater resolve in respect of support for Taiwan, and that can't be something that the Chinese are particularly pleased with, and also brought a little bit of focus back to Hong Kong. And of course, with depressed spending in the West, China's exports go down, and I noticed that a basket of Eastern Asian exporters, developing countries, have now exceeded exports over and above China for the first time in a very, very long time. There does seem to be a very broad shift going on at the moment. It'll be interesting again to see how, I suppose, a free, the UK outside of Europe can navigate those very choppy waters of international order in the coming year or two. I think Truss has a fairly large task coming up.
Yeah, and I mean, the UK can pick and choose as well what it gets involved in, because, we're sort of accepting that our role isn't a worldwide role necessarily, but it can be when the occasion demands it. But it doesn't have to be. It can be a more modest role and a more kind of, not self-centered, but certainly we can look out for our own interests in a much more single-minded fashion, without being beholden to the rest of the European Union, essentially.
Yeah. Well, I think on that, Chirino, and also because somebody's building a fence outside my window and it's buzzing in my ear. I don't know if it's going to come through on the podcast.
Yes, I hear it now.
You hear, yeah. So I think at that point, it's a good time to stop as that gets even louder. Maybe catch up quite soon and see how our new order is working out as we come into new and changing times.
Let's see what happens. Speak to you then, David.
Cheers a lot.